Two of them were mentioned in the previous chapters. The two were Jambavati, the daughter of Jambava, and Satyadama, the daughter of Satrajit. So this chapter, 58, is five more princesses. Krishna marries five princesses. Mentioned this yesterday with we discussed the Shamataka jewel and all that. These are Leelas, these are eternal associates of the personality of Godhead. When we in the Brahma Samhita prayers, Lakshmi Sahasra Satasam Brahma Sevimanam Govindam Adi Purusham Tamalam Vajami. In the spiritual world, personality of Godhead is there, and is surrounded by all of his loving associates, amongst whom there are Lakshmi Sahasra Sata. There are hundreds and thousands of goddesses of fortune, or Lakshmis. And the Lakshmis, the goddesses of fortune, are expansions of the internal potency as found in Goloka Vrindavan, that's Srimati Radharani. They're expansions of Radharani, who is his internal potency. In other words, it's a Likalak. In Vaikuntha, the majesty of the Supreme Lord predominates. And the same majesty or opulence, Aishwarya feature, is there also in Goloka Vrindavan, but abundant, so abundant, it eclipses the opulence of the Supreme Lord, his Aishwarya, in the form of his Madhurya. And that means sweetness. So the loving exchanges that Krishna has with all of his associates, it's not just Mother Jasoda and Nanda Maharaj, they're the only ones that have parental affection. All the elders of Vrindavan, they have parental affection towards Krishna. And even the cows have parental affection towards Krishna, or maternal affection. Vatsalya rasa. It's not just so. Similarly, amongst the cowherd boy friends of Krishna, his sakas, they're principal ones. They're unlimited friends. And in the Kanjubal rasa, or Madhurya rasa, the primary is Radha, and all of the other gopis, and in Dwarka, the queens, they're expansions of Krishna's internal potency. When hearing these descriptions, best to bear that in mind. The persons who are not familiar with God and his unlimited potencies, when they hear these stories, they may think, oh my God, here's a person that doesn't have to control himself. He has to have so many wives. It's not like that at all. It's not like he's like us, only he's like, doesn't have full control of himself. Not like that. God has unlimited potencies, and those unlimited potencies are manifested in such a variety of ways. And the purpose of his potencies is to bring happiness to the source of the potencies, to the potent. And that's what's happening. Krishna is exhibiting pastimes. These are his eternal associates. And he descends in this world, and they have the pastime of becoming married. But they're eternal associates. It's a pastime. So you can hear the pastime with that in mind. Because when Krishna descends, the whole of the spiritual world descends. Prabhupada gives this example. If someone says, The king is coming, the king is coming. Does that mean down the road comes the king walking alone? Ever. Even, you know, some dignitary, say the president visits, like, because it happens in New York from time to time, the president goes to the UN to deliver a message to the UN. And there is security police all over the place for a week, securing the place, you know, all over the place. And then the motorcade comes, and it's like all these cars and cars and cars, all the traffic stops, and everybody, like, God has come or something. And the president is coming to the UN. But it's not just he's, you know, walking down the street to the UN, it's just a whole big deal. So what to speak of God? When Krishna descends, he comes with all his whole abode, his associates, Govardhan Hill, and River Jamuna, and his flute, and Balaram, and the whole assembly of everybody and everything. And then he performs pastimes. So these are his eternal associates, and they're enjoying the pastime. They're not thinking, oh, this is, it's not like actors on a stage where they're thinking, oh, you know, the audience is going to enjoy this one. This is exchanges of love between the Lord and his eternal associates. And he's displaying it for the edification or to attract the hearts of us, the conditioned souls in the material world. And these are the kinds of loving exchanges that take place in the spiritual world. They're so attractive. That's over here in that way. This is the introduction, two-page introduction to the chapter summary. This chapter describes how Lord Krishna married five brides, beginning with Kalindi, and went to Indraprastha to visit the Pandavas. After the Pandavas had completed their incognito exile, Lord Krishna went with Satyaki and other Yadus to see them in Indraprastha. This incognito is the, maybe you remember from our discussion last night, those of you who were there. There was a plan by Duryodhana and his buddies to kill the Pandavas and Kunti. That was his plan. And he had a number of plans, but one of them was to send them to a summer home by a nice, you know, sacred, quiet place. Build the summer home with the most intensely inflammable material you can find at the time. Have them stay there for some time, get relaxed, and then set the house on fire. Burn them to death. That was the plan of his cousins. He wasn't a nice guy. Vidura knew the plan. In mysterious language, he informed them, just as they were leaving Hastinapur, house of lack, like made of shellac, highly inflammable. So he told them in code, the secret language, that they should build a tunnel underneath, from the house, underneath the house, going outside for some distance and After the Pandavas had completed their incognito exile, Lord Krishna went with Satyaki and other Yadus to see them in Indraprastha. So a place was made for them to stay, and it was given the name Indraprastha. The Pandavas greeted the Lord and embraced him in ecstasy. Their new bride, Draupadi, shyly approached Krishna and bowed down to him. Then the Pandavas properly worshipped and welcomed Satyaki and Lord Krishna's other companions, offering them seats sitting places. Paragraph. Lord Krishna paid a visit to Queen Kunti, and after he had offered her his respects, they inquired from each other about their family members, because Kunti is the sister of Krishna's father's Vasudeva, and Kunti the brother and sister. So here's Aunt Kunti meeting with her nephew Krishna, and they're talking about family members, because Krishna had transferred everybody to Dwarka. And Kalyavana and Jarasandha simultaneously were attacking Mathura. He arranged for Dwarka to be built, transferred everybody there, settled them there. They're all relatives of Kunti. So Krishna had come from Dwarka, and she's asking, how are all my relatives doing? Like that. As Kunti Devi recalled the various miseries Duryodhana had inflicted upon her and her sons, she remarked that Krishna was their only protector. Quote, "You are the well-wisher of the entire universe," she said, "even though you are free from all delusion of mine and another's. You, nonetheless, reside within the hearts of those who meditate on you constantly, and from within their hearts you destroy all their miseries." Then Yudhisthira told Krishna, "Only because we executed many pious acts are we able to see your lotus feet, which even great yogis find it impossible to attain." Honored by King Yudhisthira, Sri Krishna happily remained as a guest in Indraprastha for several months. And this is, while this was going on, is when the killing of Satrajit took place. One day, Krishna and Arjuna went hunting in the forest. While bathing in the Jamuna River, they saw a charming young maiden. On Krishna's request, Arjuna went up to the girl and asked who she was. David replied, "I am Kalindi, the daughter of the sun god." This is another name of Jamuna. This is described in the sixth canto. Some our sun god, hoping to attain Lord Vishnu as my husband. I have been performing severe austerities. I will accept no one else as my husband. And until he marries me, I will remain in the Yamuna, living in a house my father has built for me here. A house inside the river. Doesn't give any detail. After Arjuna reported all this to Krishna, the omniscient Lord Krishna took Kalindi on his chariot, and then the three of them returned to Yudhisthira's residence. She became his wife. Kalindi. Later, the Pandavas requested Krishna to build them a city. And he did so by having Vishvakarma, the architect of the demigods, construct one that was extremely attractive. The Lord satisfied his beloved devotees by remaining with them for some time, as mentioned several months. Then, to please Agni, the fire god, Krishna arranged to offer him the Kandava forest. The Lord asked Arjuna to burn down the forest and accompany him as his charioteer. Agni was so satisfied with the offering that he presented Arjuna with the Gandiva bow. We hear about that in Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna's Gandiva bow. A team of horses, chariot, two inexhaustible quivers, and armor. While the Kandava forest burned, Arjuna saved a demon, Maya, from the blaze. Maya Danava reciprocated by building Arjuna a splendid palace. In this building, Duryodhana would later get a good drenching after mistaking the surface of a pond for a solid floor, and thus embarrassing himself. Here's a detail of that one. Heard in the lecture once, and I tried to find it again, and I couldn't find it again. The Prabhupada was describing. So, Maya Danava, he's described elsewhere in the 10th canto also. He was very expert in mystical things. He was a yogi, not a good kind of yogi. Mischievous kind of things with his yoga abilities. So when he was rescued by Arjuna, he was very grateful. And so he volunteered, "I'd like to do some service for you. You've saved my life. I'd like to give you all of the mysteries I have in the area of technology, how to, you know, the push and pull of things, how to get things done." Arjuna turned to Krishna. Krishna said, "No, this will destroy everything. Don't accept that." So then he offered to build them a city. So it was a mystical city in one sense, where that which appeared to be pools of water wasn't pools of water, it was land. And that which was land appeared to be pools of water. So Duryodhana at this time, he had already tried to kill the Pandavas by the house of Lath. And he already tried to kill Bhima through poison cake. But he, at least the way the narration goes, was he was honored. He was a proud person. He wanted to be honored by them. So when he heard that they had this fabulous city, and he received an invitation from them because they were trying to pacify one who was seeing them in an inimitable way, down the water. He was embarrassed, very angry. And from that point on, it was, I have to get rid of the water. I can't stand it. It was like, if there was any good in him, it was gone. By the burning envy and embarrassment, get back on the bus. Well, this is a significant part of Mahabharata. Next, Lord Krishna took permission from Arjuna and his other relatives and went back to Dwarka with his entourage. There he married Kalindi. Sometime later he went to Avantipura, where, in the presence of many kings, he abducted the king of Avanti's sister, Mitravinda, who was very much attracted to him. We're going to hear about that in the chapter. So that's two of five. In the kingdom of Ayodhya lived a devout king named Naganajit. He had an extraordinarily beautiful marriageable daughter named Satya, or Naganajiti. Girl's relatives had laid down the stipulation that any man who could subdue a certain group of seven ferocious bulls would win her hand. When Krishna heard about this princess, he went to Ayodhya with a large contingent of soldiers. King Naganajit greeted him hospitably and joyfully worshipped him with various offerings. When Satya saw Krishna, she immediately desired him as her husband, and King Naganajit, understanding his daughter's intentions, informed Lord Krishna of his own wish that the Lord and his daughter be married. The king affectionately told the Lord, "You alone will be a suitable husband for my daughter, and if you subdue the seven bulls, you may certainly marry her." Lord Krishna then manifested himself in seven separate forms and subdued the seven bulls. Pretty good. King Naganajit duly presented his daughter to the Lord, together with a dowry of abundant gifts, and the Lord took Satya onto his chariot for the journey back to Dwarka. Just then, the rival kings who had been defeated by the bulls tried to attack Lord Krishna, but Arjuna easily beat them back, and Krishna proceeded with Naganajiti to Dwarka. And last paragraph, subsequently, Sri Krishna married Bhadra after abducting her from her Swayambar ceremony. And he also married Lakshmana, the royal daughter of the king of Madra. So, very exciting chapter. Marriages are always attractive to people. Here's five. Very special. Just a few verses. Text one. Shukadeva Goswami said once, the supremely opulent personality of Godhead went to Indraprastha to visit the Pandavas, who had again appeared in public. Accompanying the Lord were Yuyudhana and other associates. Report. Almost everyone except Lord Krishna and Lord Balaram had thought the Pandavas perished in the fire set by Duryodhana in the house of Lak. Now the Pandavas had appeared again in public, and Krishna was paying them a visit. Next two. When the Pandavas saw that Lord Mukunda had arrived, those heroes of Pritha, sons of Pritha, heroic sons of Pritha, all stood up at once. Inasaha here refers to the suffering caused by separation from Krishna. That happiness was now vanquished by the Lord's return. Simply by contact with the Supreme Pure, starting with His holy name, this is Canto 6, the Ajamila story, is told to illustrate the point. But the point is, by contact with the Supreme Pure, one becomes pure. There are processes that are not contact with the Supreme Pure directly, but they're processes of atonement. Processes of atonement. So something that's done that's bad, and you do something to counteract that thing that was done bad. Prabhupada gives the example within the state. You break the law, you pay a fine for breaking the law. So you're relieved of the reaction of having broken the law by paying a fine. So in different religions, there's a process of atonement. Prayuschitta in Sanskrit. So you, like one of them is confessing of one's sins. You go to the priest. Some religions have this practice. You go to the priest, you confess your sins, and the priest then prescribes a particular atonement. You give some contribution, put something in the money box, and you say certain set of prayers. In Catholicism, it's so many Hail Mary prayers and your rosary. And now there's you atone. And then regularly you go back to the priest and confess your sins. And you take the idea is to get released from the reactions of your sins. Prabhupada's point, and the point in the Bhagavatam, in the sixth canto, is while that may neutralize the sin and is the reaction of the sin, it doesn't take away the tendency to do the sin again. It's like the root and the root of a weed, and you clip the top of the weed. In your yard, you may have some dandelions. Maybe here in Arizona, you don't have a yard. But where there's grassy yards, and there's a weed, you clip the top of the weed. But the root is there, so it's going to grow again. So the Bhagavatam's teaching is the process of atonement can effectively neutralize the reaction, but it doesn't take away the tendency. So that's one whole section of the Vedas and the section of religion of how you deal with reactions of sins. You atone for them by different methods. Different methods. Then it staying fixed in the spiritual conception and living one's life according to the spiritual conception has a very strong tendency of checking the tendency for sin. But knowledge alone is not enough, because even we may know better, we may still do something that's not wholesome, not good for us, not in our best interest, simply because of the lower modes of nature pushing, and then something that's ignorant intervening inside this realm of knowledge. So that's the Gyanakanda system, processes of religion, the antidote for sin. Is to become very, very strongly fixed in knowledge and following the rules of the scripture and inadvertent mistakes. There's a process of atonement, so you combine the two. Processes of atonement along with strength of knowledge. Bhagavatam concludes, that's good. It's even better than good. But it's not sufficient, because still the tendency can manifest itself. So then the Bhagavatam is prescribing this method of directly contacting the Supreme Pure. And the primary means, that's what bhakti is, primary means is through the holy name, or it begins with the holy name, hearing, shravanam. Shravanam, kirtanam. When you do enough shravanam, kirtanam, hearing and chanting, heart becomes cleansed. And when the heart becomes cleansed, then remembrance of who we are, our spiritual identity, not the material one, the spiritual identity. There's this covering, and for the time being I'm in this body or that body or some body. But that's my identity, is the spirit soul, eternally part of it. By hearing and chanting, that consciousness awakens. Remembrance, Vishuddha Smaranam. Remembrance of God and my relationship with Him. My true identity is a spirit soul, part and parcel of Him. It flows very naturally through the hearing and chanting. And then comes praying and worshipping at lotus feet and so forth. The other processes of bhakti all flow from nicely hearing and chanting on the topics of Krishna. Krishna's holy, starting simply with Krishna's holy name, because everything is there in Krishna's holy name. Just like this earlier example, the king is coming. The king is coming means his whole entourage is coming. The whole spiritual world is there. Simply within Krishna's name, the whole spiritual world is there, because where Krishna is there, the whole spiritual world is there. Everything is there, just in that sound vibration. Krishna. And it's not just stuff, or like spiritual stuff, but it's Satchit Ananda Vigraha, the eternity knowledge and bliss with full spiritual form. Purnashuddho Nityamukto Abhinatvam Nama Namino, in the language of Padma Purana. The holy name is Purnashuddho. It's invested with complete purity, just as Krishna is the supreme pure. His holy name is supremely pure. Purnashuddho. Nityamukto. Eternally liberated, never contaminated. It may descend into this dark place, material world. The name of Krishna doesn't become contaminated by the dark place. Rather, the impurity becomes purified by the Supreme Pure, by Krishna. And when we contact the holy name, or the pastimes of Krishna, the form of Krishna, the qualities of Krishna, as presented in Srimad Bhagavatam, the Bhagavatam, or the holy name, or the deity form of the Lord, or the mercy of the Lord, never becomes contaminated or polluted. when he now returned after having not seen him for some time. It was as if all their sins were now gone away. But there's no sin for the Pandavas because they're eternal associates of the personality of Godhead. So Jiva Goswami is indicating this is a little Sanskrit rule. The Sanskrit rule is direct meaning must be taken unless it's just inappropriate. Only in those circumstances can a secondary meaning be taken. Otherwise, the primary meaning must be taken. Like, here's a nice example. Krishna says, Sarva Dharmam Paritya Vamekam Sharanam Praja. So the direct meaning is very clear. Krishna is saying, Vamekam Sharanam. That's the direct meaning. Mam. First person singular. To me, unto me. Ekam, alone. Sharanam, surrender. So the direct meaning is very clear. The direct meaning is to be taken. Now, there are some commentators that take an indirect meaning. That's a no-no by Sanskrit rule. They say, don't surrender to Krishna. Surrender to the unborn, unmanifest within Krishna. There's a little... The other day someone was asking a question, when Prabhupada came to America, why did he bring Srimad Bhagavatam for his canto instead of Bhagavad Gita? And the answer I gave was Prabhupada had planned to print the Bhagavad Gita commentary that he had written. He had a manuscript. He wanted to find a publisher in America. He got this ticket, this passage on a steamship to come to America. So he took his manuscript with him rather than printing it in India and trying to carry lots of books in a trunk. He just took the manuscript to have it printed in America. And when you read Lilamrita carefully, you'll find that when Prabhupada was living in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, in the Bowery, one of the devotees, or I guess devotee, one of the friends of the devotees had a loft. You know what a loft is? Like, just like a big space that's kind of raw and undeveloped. In the Bowery. The Bowery was like Bum's Row. Bowery. Now it's not so much like that. But then it was, you know, drunkards lying on the street. They're drinking their wine and just pass out on the street. That was, you know, Prabhupada would go for his morning walk. He'd have to step over the bums lying, sleeping on the, you know, homeless people sleeping on the street. Intoxicated with wine. Winos. So, that's where he lived on, one of the upper floors of Bowery. And when he lived there, someone broke into the room where he was still locked, stole his little manual from India, portable typewriter, you know, like of that kind. You strike the key and they stole the typewriter, they stole the manuscript. What's a manuscript going to be for a criminal, a thief? Totally useless. But his manuscript was stolen, so he had to do it again. So in the course of doing it again, he still wanted to teach Bhagavad Gita to the students. So he requested one of the devotees to go to a bookstore and get Bhagavad Gita. And so they went to a bookstore, found Bhagavad Gita, and brought it back. I won't tell you who the author was, or the translator, but I'll tell you what Prabhupada did. He wanted the devotees to understand what it means to interpret, or secondary meaning suddenly becomes the primary meaning. And it's a no-no for a Sanskrit scholar. You must take the primary meaning, not the secondary meaning. The Prabhupada read, there's two places that he was, I wasn't there, but I heard it so many times. Prabhupada read, Krishna says, surrender unto me. Commentary. Do not surrender to Krishna. Krishna means to surrender to the unborn, unmanifest within. Prabhupada made a fist, banged it on his desk very firmly, said, just see what he's doing. Then he read it again. Krishna says, surrender it to me. Commentary. Krishna doesn't mean to surrender it to him. He means to surrender to the unborn, unmanifest within him. Fist. Boom. Just see what he's doing. He did it again. The devotees could understand. Then there's another. Manana bhava mad bhakto madhyaji mam namaskuru. Very famous verse. Commentary. Krishna doesn't mean to think of him. He means to think of the unborn, unmanifest within him. Just see what he's doing. Cheating. Cheating is against the Sanskrit rules. But why is he doing that? Why will somebody cheat like that? Because they're enemies of Krishna. So don't surrender to Krishna. Something else. But don't surrender to Krishna. Don't think of Krishna. Rest alone, you can say. Rest alone. So here's a case where the word in the Sanskrit is enasaha. Enasaha indicates released from sin. So Jiva Goswami said the first meaning is not appropriate because the Pandavas are sinless, eternal associates of Krishna. So what does it mean? You have to go to a secondary meaning. They were suffering not from sin, but they were suffering from feelings of separation. Feeling separation from Krishna, they were like dead. I mean, they weren't dead, but they were lifeless. But now life came back because Krishna came. Like the example, when someone is unconscious and they come out of consciousness, that the senses become animated again because consciousness is restored. When consciousness is dormant, the senses are dormant. So Krishna comes, consciousness is awakened. And then they become very animated. This is the consequence of attachment for Krishna. So naturally, what do devotees like to do? Like to be with Krishna. And how do you be with Krishna? You hear about him. You remember him. You serve him. You worship him. You talk about him. You engage your whole energy. Body-minded words and Krishna and Krishna's service. In the first canto, this is 10th canto, chapter 58. In the first canto, chapter something like 10 or 11, there's a series of chapters where Krishna is leaving Mathura. Krishna tries to leave Mathura. Uttara comes. Krishna, Krishna, save the child in my womb. Krishna saved the child in her womb. Next. Krishna is about to get on his chariot. Kunti comes through the crowd in the public arena. And because she's Queen Kunti, she can go wherever she wants. She came right up to Krishna's chariot. And pleaded with Krishna, please don't go. And she offered beautiful prayers. And Krishna smiled, got ready to get on his chariot again. And Yudhisthira came and pleaded with Krishna, glancing at them, through their eyes, they're taking in the form of Krishna that goes into their hearts. Beautiful description. And in their hearts, they embrace Krishna, and they feel as satisfied in their hearts as if they had embraced Krishna with their senses. That's Krishna consciousness. And then one after the next, after that, the different associates, different rasas, the sons are sent by the queens, because it would not be appropriate that they come running. So they send their sons. Krishna embraces his sons. And by Krishna's embrace of his sons, the queens are feeling as happy as Krishna's embracing them, because he's embracing their sons. So very beautiful. And then Krishna goes and pays his respects to the elders. So there's that exchange of affection. And then he goes to meet his queens. And there's that exchange of affection. So Krishna is now enlivening everyone. So along with Krishna's journey from Hastinapur back to Dwarka, Arjuna was sent by Yudhisthira to accompany Krishna for two reasons. One, just honoring Krishna. The royal family, now ruling the world, is sending one of the brothers to accompany Krishna back to Dwarka. It's honorific. But the other was very practical. They, the Pandavas, had a sense that Krishna's pastimes may be concluded. They didn't want to say it, but intuitively they understood it. So Arjuna was to find out and send a report back. Long time passed in silence. And there's this whole chapter of the ill omens that everybody saw, and they knew what it meant, they just didn't want to say it. Krishna's gone. And Arjuna had been gone for months. So they were in big anxiety, but they didn't want to say what everybody knew, that Krishna was gone. Finally, Arjuna comes back, and Yudhisthira receives him very warmly, the elder brother receiving the younger brother. Please give us the good news. Although Arjuna looked devastated. He knew, but just didn't want to say. And Arjuna just burst out crying, sobbing and sobbing and weeping and saying it, Krishna's gone. And as he's speaking about Krishna is gone, he's speaking about how he remembers Krishna, the ways in which Krishna was kind upon them, the ways in which he and Krishna did things together. His relationship with Krishna, his exchanges with Krishna, his exchanges with the Pandavas. Then he starts remembering the teachings that Krishna gave him in Bhagavad Gita in the battlefield of Kurukshetra. And as he's describing the ways in which he has this relationship with Krishna, he starts to become vitalized again. Then he realizes, Krishna gave his association to me through the teachings of Bhagavad Gita so that I would always be connected with him. That's relevant to us too. We can remain connected with Krishna. We're not members of the royal family, far from it. We're not the Pandavas or directly related to them. But the same principle applies. When Lord Achyuta came back, the heroes embraced Lord Achyuta and the touch of his body freed them of sin, is the translation. It freed them of the pang of separation. And so the material world, why does sin come? What's the root cause of sin? It's turning our back on God. So the solution of the root cause is turn your attention to God. So when you fully turn your attention to God, the feelings of sin is certainly gone, and the reactions of sin is gone, and the feelings of enlightenment so many things to serve God, rather than the sinful tendency of doing things away from God, or in darkness, or without consideration of God's interest, which generally means sinful. You study Bhagavad Gita, right? In Prabhupada's purports, each of the times Arjuna addresses Krishna in a different way, it has some meaning. So, you know the meaning of Mukunda, giver of liberation. And Achyuta means infallible. The living entity is Chyuta. Krishna is Achyuta. We're fallible, Krishna is infallible. So, he's being addressed in the Bhagavatam in this way. Invariably, Krishna is untainted by anything of this world, and his association is very uplifting. So, it's a connotation, or an aspect of Krishna. And Mukunda, give her liberation. So, one who's in struggling hard with the material energy, struggling very hard with material energy. Where is our shelter? Mukunda, the giver of liberation. But it's a connotation, it's an aspect. The name is indicating a feature of God. It's specific to the verse and the application, the message that's being presented in the verse. one-sixth of the piety of the king transfers to the citizens. Impiety of the king transfers to the citizens. Same, father and son. If the father is very pious, even the son doesn't do anything. I mean, like it's just a clean slate. They are receiving merit from their father. And the opposite is also true. If the father is sinful, the part of, so we're connected. So there's individual karma and there's group karma. If a nation or a group of people do something, one amongst the group does something very sinful, then the negative influence goes to the group. There's a nice example of this in Chaitanya Charitamrita, but without the example. Yes. Then there's transcendence. So, if the son, if the father is pious, I receive some of the benefit of my father's piety. Impious, I receive some of the impiety. But then transcendental can neutralize the whole thing. Therefore, the recommendation of Scripture is, don't just try to build piety, but engage in surrender to the personality of Godhead, the devotional service to the personality of Godhead, in that mood of surrender, and one is protected. The reactions of all impiety are all removed. Just by that devotional service. So whether my father and mother, or one's father and mother, may be pious and pious, that has some bearing on my, some portion of my piety and piety. But by devotional service, one can transcend that influence altogether. The reactions of sins that I've done and my previous generation me have done, it's neutralized by the process of devotional service and surrender to Krishna. Good news, huh? Yes. Children benefit from your devotional service?
Yes.
Sure. Sure. It doesn't mean necessarily they're going to do devotional service, but they get benefit for sure. They get benefit for sure. According to the whole story of King Rika, who gave cows to brahmanas, and, you know that story? Krishna book? Read the Krishna book story of King Rika. At the end, it explains. By if you become a pure devotee, 10 generations before and after you get the opportunity to engage in pure devotional service, that kind of liberation. Just by your doing devotional service, they don't have to do anything. Now, as a mother of children, you want not just they get the benefit of your devotional service, you want them, you as mother, naturally you wish for them to voluntarily choose devotional service to Krishna. So part of that is your own devotional service that